kiss your lips a thousand times and more times than I can count. I have called you mine. You have stood by me in my
life from New York City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. You can watch today's show by going to ustream.tv and then search for Gary Null. A lot of people are listening over the telephone. That's a good thing because that means you're not limited to being in front of a computer or from a terrestrial radio. Our telephone number, you can call anywhere in North America and Canada, 619-550-0869, 619-550-0869. Today, I'm going to share the latest on oranges. I think a lot of people simply take oranges for granted. Well, we get vitamin C. Actually, we don't get a lot of vitamin C from an orange. So I'll give you a more in-depth analysis of what's really in orange, from William Gamonski. Then, I didn't have a chance yesterday, time did not permit, to give you the latest on why, if you want to turn off pain and inflammation in your joints, your brain, your eyes, your heart, your lungs, your kidney, and your liver, you should be taking tart cherries. Michael Downey provides the latest on that. Is it true that resveratrol, a simple nutrient found in grapes and some other foods, can really slow down the aging process? Margie King shares the latest on that. Also today, a more in-depth analysis about our environment and what we really have to be concerned about. One of it is water. We do have enough water right now to drink, at least most people do in the United States. The problem is the water for irrigating food that we consume, or secondarily through the cattle or chickens or pigs that people consume who are fed grains. That's a big problem because we're running out of water, and in some places they've already run out. What to do? Lester Brown provides an in-depth analysis, continuing an ongoing commentary on how, when we forget about the past and the forces, the neoliberal forces and globalization, the people who brought us GATT and NAFTA are now trying to bring us the Trans-Pacific Partnership, how we're going to victimize ourselves, because they're serious. They're organized. They have their lobbyists, over 600 lobbyists working on crafting a bill that you and I and members of Congress are not allowed to know about. And then President Obama wants to fast-track it. He wants us not to be able to stop this. But how does this help us? And why would he want something that's supposed to be in our benefit secret? I'll deal with that. Let's begin. First up, there are different types of vitamin E. And one of the best ways of taking your vitamin E is from a natural mix tocopherols. This is the latest study from Experimental Biology, the peer-reviewed journal, on just one of those, gamma tocopherol. It helps people who want to stop smoking. Quote, the results of the study suggest a cardiovascular benefit for the form of vitamin E known as gamma tocopherol among individuals who recently have given up smoking. The study included participants who had smoked for at least several years, 10 cigarettes a day. They were given 500 milligrams of gamma tocopherol or a placebo for 7 days. Ultrasound evaluations of brachial arterial flow mediated dilation, that means in lay language a measure of blood vessel function, was conducted, and plasma levels of carnitine, vitamin E, and pro-inflammatory mediators were measured before and after the treatment period. And it was shown that you have better functioning when you're taking gamma tocopherol. That's good. So those who are trying to quit smoking, I'm going to suggest 800 units of mixed tocopherols, because it's not just gamma, but delta, alpha, that also work as well, along with tocotrienols. Separately, from the considered the most prestigious journal in the world, Nature, they talked about a small gland in the brain that has profound processing applications for aging. And the brain is the container of what is called the hypothalamus. And an MD-PhD, a Dr. Chai at Yeshiva University, evaluated inflammatory changes in the hypothalamus that have been associated with a metabolic syndrome, a cluster of symptoms including glucose intolerance and obesity and diabetes. They found that activation in the hypothalamus of a protein known as nuclear factor kappa beta was involved in inflammation, accelerating the aging process. So here is the idea. Now they know that there are key glands and organs in the body that once you have a pro-inflammatory item, any item, it triggers the body, and hence you end up with all this inflammation. So in lay language, how would that look? Well, let's say you took a cup of coffee, pro-inflammatory. You have a soft drink, inflammatory. A grilled cheese sandwich, inflammatory. French fries, pizza, inflammatory. Sugary dessert, inflammatory. Pesticides on your food, inflammatory. Alcohol, extremely inflammatory. So now imagine each day that the average person is having multiple pro-inflammatory ingredients go into their body. Those then trigger the hypothalamus to create inflammation in the brain. And that then creates a lot of free radicals, which can cause destruction of your neurons. And that leads to memory loss, dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. So for decades, when myself and others were putting people on gluten-free, dairy-free, high-juice, alkaline diets, we were absolutely on the right side of science, public health, and history. Those individuals who were looking for the magic drug that would turn off the pain, they're the ones who gave us death and destruction. They gave us Vioxx and aspirins and other drugs that can block the pain but don't stop the underlying cause. Could you imagine how many people would be alive today and how many less people would be suffering from pain if their doctor told them to use the same type or a similar diet to the Mediterranean diet, for example? But they wouldn't do that. That's unfortunate. A lot of people, according to the Journal of Clinical Critical Care, who are sick, critically sick, are low in coenzyme Q10. Quote, this is from the article. Levels revealed lower levels of coenzyme Q10 in critically ill patients in comparison with healthy men and women. So that means that you need coenzyme Q10. Why do you think you feel so fatigued when you are sick? It's because the mitochondria aren't able to function at the same level, creating ATP, adenosine triphosphate. And coenzyme Q10 is essential in creating energy for your heart and your brain and your eyes. So that's one more reason to make sure you're getting your Q10. It's one of your 10 most important nutrients that you must take into your body every day. One more major study published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Thoracic and Cardiovascular Surgery. This was results of multiple studies that showed that omega-3 fatty acids provides, quote, significant protection against arterial fibrillation in open heart surgery patients. By the way, I'm also fully aware that it also helps it in people who have not had any surgery but simply have irregular heartbeats. It's one of the best ways to rebalance your heartbeat. And to help your brain function better, phosphatidylserine, or PS. Here's the latest from Tel Aviv University, published in the peer-reviewed journal Human Molecular Genetics. They found that phosphatidylserine could be a benefit to individuals with family disorders, and they used the Ashkenazi Jewish men and women who have similar mutations in the genes that inhibit the manufacture of IB kinase complex-associated protein, or what's called IKAP, which is believed to be involved in genetic transcription. And phosphatidylserine was able to help these individuals. So one more reason why phosphatidylserine holds promise for brain disorders and memory. It's one of the best things you can take for memory. If you're an asthmatic patient, there's a new study out that shows that, published by the American Thoracic Society, shows that ginger benefits asthmatic patients. It allows a relaxation of the airway smooth muscle tissue and therefore helps to prevent asthmatic attacks. Dr. Elizabeth Townsend of Columbia University and her colleagues studied the effects of 6 gingerol and 6 shogol in human airway smooth muscle tissue samples, and found that ginger made a difference. One more reason to have ginger. Now, one of the foods that we all consume, probably as a juice more than eating it, is are oranges. There are a large variety of oranges. But a long time ago in the lab, when I was doing an analysis of the different vitamin contents, I said, well, it's just not possible that the small amount of vitamin C in an orange is what's making the orange beneficial. So we knew that there was something else in there. Turns out there's a lot of somethings in an orange other than the vitamin C. In fact, there's 60 different flavonoids. And that is what makes the orange so important. It's a very rich source of what is called hesperidin and naringin. And these are helping to boost eye health, fight heart disease, prevent kidney stones, and enhance immunity. So oranges are inexpensive, and they're very easy to grow. I have oranges growing in my home, and most of the other people who live in a climate that allows oranges to grow, you can easily grow them. And but what we didn't know is that it has all this other thing. Has folate, thiamine, lots of potassium. An average orange has over 300 milligrams of potassium. That's good for your heart. Has calcium in there. And it has anywhere between 30 to about 100 milligrams of vitamin C, depending upon the size of the orange. And organic oranges have more nutrients. But let me just give you a few examples of what the orange does, and hence why. And orange juice is fine, especially if it's raw and unpasteurized, and you can juice it yourself and drink it. All that's good. But for people who are more seriously ill, especially people who have eye conditions, macular degeneration, cataracts, or glaucoma, I always suggest juicing the entire orange. That means that wash the peel, that means the seeds, everything gets juiced. The same is true for lemons, limes, and grapefruit, because an enormous amount of the healing power of citrus is in the skin, and we throw that away. Now, glaucoma is a term that a lot of people are afraid of, because it's defined by structural abnormalities in the nerve fibers of the eye structures as well as in the optic nerve itself. And it can result in permanent vision loss if it's not treated. We know that the carotenoids, including lutein and other beta nutrients like cryptotoxin, along with vitamin C, make oranges very important for protecting the eyes. In one study, researchers at the University of California revealed that those consuming more than 2 servings of fresh oranges per week had 82% reduction in glaucoma risk compared to those who ingested less than 2 servings a week. And a very recent study published in the Journal of Neuroscience also suggest that vitamin C in oranges might be largely responsible for this powerful protective effect. And retinal nerve cells containing GABA receptors, which help modulate their transmission of electrical signals to the brain, and without sufficient amounts of the vitamin, GABA receptors malfunction, causing retinal nerve cells to fire signals at an excessive rate. And this constant overwork causes nerve cells to burn out and induces cell death. And vitamin C, rich oranges allow GABA receptors to function properly, and thereby protecting against the loss of retinal nerve cells and preserving your vision. And along with glaucoma, a greater intake of oranges is promising for defending against age-related macular degeneration. So those are good things that come when you have your oranges. And always try to get organic oranges. It'll also protect your heart. There's a good study in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition that found that participants who increased risk of cardiovascular disease ingesting about 2 cups of red orange juice daily for 1 week. Again, you reduce your risk of heart disease substantially by 38.5% in the endothelial function by having 2 cups of red orange juice daily for 1 week. That's terrific. In a separate study, French researchers observed comparable results between orange juice and hesperidin, a supplementation on endothelial function and diastolic blood pressure. So that's good in 4 weeks. And it also can help prevent kidney stones. And that's very common in the United States. 1 in 11 individuals in the U.S. has kidney stones or will suffer from kidney stones. So we now know that you're less likely to have kidney stones if you have orange juice. So get your orange juice. But also you should be getting your cherry concentrate, your tart cherry concentrate. It's very important. It turns off pain. It modulates numerous pathways to protect against other conditions like inflammation, including cancer, cardiovascular disease, metabolic syndrome, and Alzheimer's, all of which are important. For example, tart cherries constitutes one of the most important things for helping critical genes switch on or off and modulate cell signaling molecules like tumor necrosis factor and target multiple cardiovascular factors, producing in one study an astounding 65% reduction in early death. Again, this is all in good science. Let me just give you an example. One of nature's most potent classes of flavonoids are called the anthocyanins. Now, these powerful nutrients are responsible for the deep colors in some berries and fruits and vegetables. Naturally, like other anthocyanin-rich foods, tart cherries deliver substantial antioxidant, anti-inflammatory activity. But tart cherries are superior because they provide high levels of some novel anthocyanins that are absent from other cherries and other berries. Like they're absent, you don't find them in blueberries or bilberries. And also the unique composition of tart cherries goes far beyond anthocyanins. In fact, tart cherries were shown to contain much higher amounts of total phenolics, phen, P-H-E-N, olics, O-L-I-C-S, than their nutritious cousin, sweet cherries. And aside from the greater abundance of anthocyanins, tart cherries also deliver a cast of supporting compounds. Tart cherries are ranked 14th among the top 50 foods for the highest antioxidant content per serving, including surpassing dark chocolate and red wine. And this complex profile has been shown to benefit us in other ways. For example, bioactive compounds found in tart cherries beneficially inhibit certain enzymes while boosting others, switch on our cancer defenses, downregulate glucose, helping diabetics, enhance primary antioxidants, all of that to our betterment. For example, as an athlete, I'm always concerned about how I can recover from my workouts, especially when I'm training for serious competition. Now, in another another year, I start my world training, my world games training, and I'll train for 9 months. And it'll be looking like one of those Rocky movies. It'll be 4 hours every morning, probably doing 18 miles of road work, an hour of strenuous biking and highest resistance gear, an hour on the VersaClimber, and heavy leg work. So it's a big burn. And then your muscles are fatigued. There's a fine line between pushing yourself to your maximum conditioning. Because remember, when you're in a race like the World Games, first you have to go through local races, state races, national races, indoor nationals. Then you go to the outdoor nationals. And then you see what your competition is. Because you first have to be amongst the best five in America to get on an American team. And then you're up against the best teams in the world, sometimes against 40, 50 different teams. So there's a whole lot of people in that 20K race, that 12-mile race. Now, the last time I did, I brought back the gold, and the time before that, I brought back the silver. One of our team members ended up getting injured in the last mile. Otherwise, we'd have taken the gold in that instead of the silver. So it's a lot of training. So I take specific nutrients and juices every day while I'm doing my training. And this time I'm going to film my whole process, my first day and all my biologicals, all my medical records, all my biochemistry, the blood workups. I'm going to post it, show you, and then every day I'm going to have it filmed. So anyone else who wants to do some ultimate training for whatever competition can at least use this as a model to know things you can do to help prevent injury and to maximize physical performance. But high intensity or prolonged physical activity of any kind typically causes muscle damage, and that results in oxidative stress and inflammation and pain. And as people age, muscle mass and strength tend to decrease in a process called sarcopenia. Now, although exercise can help overcome this process, post-exercise pain and loss of strength tend to last much longer. And the observed anti-inflammatory benefits of tart cherries prompted researchers to investigate whether they could be used to protect muscles and lower pain and accelerate muscle repair. And research demonstrated that just drinking tart cherry concentrate each day, loaded with those anthocyanins, significantly lowered inflammation-induced pain in this experiment. Then researchers turned to controlled human trials, and it found that it made a major difference, a big difference. So, reduce pain with tart cherries, and you get faster recovery. So that's just some of the things that cherries do, but it does a lot more. It protects our heart. In fact, it helps our joints. For anyone out there who has joint problems, joint swelling, joint pain, arthritis, it's essential to understand that one out of every two Americans will develop symptoms of osteoarthritis at some point in their lifetime. And osteoarthritis is a chronic condition characterized by a breakdown of joint cartilage that leads to pain and injury. So osteoarthritis has a strong inflammatory component. And most people use a pain medication to get rid of it. But there was a study at Baylor Research Institute where tart cherries were given in pill form to patients with osteoarthritis of the knee, and they documented that after 8 weeks, more than half the subjects experienced a significant improvement in pain and function. And then there was a study this past year, a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled trial, was presented at the annual meeting of the American College of Sports Medicine. And scientists measured the impacts of tart cherry on serum inflammatory biomarkers among inflammatory osteoarthritis patients. And they found a substantial improvement when they consumed about 10 ounces, two 10-ounce bottles of tart cherry juice a week. And gout, it really works for gout. And if you're overweight and you have pain from being overweight, it helps that as well. And it even helps if you have cancer. It can help switch off genes involved in the multiple pathways of cancer. And these genes include the cell proliferation and the inflammatory and the angiogenesis, meaning the growth of new blood vessel genes. And the anthocyanidins in tartares can also trigger apoptosis, the programmed cell death that causes precancer cells to self-destruct. And these studies establish that anthocyanidins in tartares work through a network of mechanisms and help you at every level. And it also helps your brain and helps with diabetes. That's right. They're neuroprotective. So anyone with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, Huntington's disease, Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, you should be using tart cherry juice. It can protect your neurons. That's the latest on health and nutrition. And oh yes, I did mention resveratrol. According to a study on molecular nutrition and food research, they examined the results of thousands of laboratory studies with enzymes, culture cells, and laboratory animals. And we now look at resveratrol, a chemical that's found in certain plants and acts as an antibiotic to fight off both bacteria and fungus. It's very high in raspberries, mulberries, blueberries, and cranberries. And it's also found in peanuts and pine nuts. And very good. So the word is resveratrol is very important for our health, and it manifests important benefits in Alzheimer's, in people overweight, people with inflammation. So yeah, it works. So resveratrol. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us. From our environmental segment today, you've heard me mentioning that I'm concerned that we are guessing without any accurate model what's going to happen when enough water is released from glaciers, Antarctica, Greenland, that it can create a warming of the oceans, that can create an expansion of the water, that can create a greater surge inland in storms, and that can create more devastating hurricanes. I believe that in the next 3 to 5 years, we will see at least one or more Category 5 hurricanes hit the United States. And we are ill-prepared for any of this because we have permanent structures, but without permanent defensives. And yet, the water is coming. This is the latest, just from this morning. I'll report this from Common Dream staff. Quote, hundreds of American cities are already locked into watery futures, and we are growing that group very rapidly, end quote. Now, that message was from Dr. Ben Strauss, the lead author of a new analysis of climate change data that shows the amount of carbon pollution already in the atmosphere could lead to, quote, more than 4 feet of sea level rise past today's levels, and, quote, that would end up, and especially enough at high tide, to submerge more than half of today's population in 316 coastal cities and towns in the lower 48 states. And that means that the worst hit places would be Miami, Virginia Beach, Sacramento, California, Jacksonville, Florida, Boston, Massachusetts, Long Beach, California, and New York City. And this was published in Climate Central, the peer-reviewed journal. So I've been saying this for about 7 years now, that you better pay attention because we're getting to a point where one day we'll go to sleep and we'll wake up and we'll hear that a major shift has occurred, unexpected, beyond any mathematical model, and that climatologists are surprised and aghast because there was no way of predicting that it would happen that fast. When they had the comfort of modeling climate change, they could tell us, don't worry, it won't happen in your lifetimes. It'll happen 100, 200 years from now. Now it's happening now. Look at Sandy, Katrina. That's now. Look at the flooding today, as I'm speaking today in Western Europe and in other parts of the world. Look at the drought, the worst on record, now happening in 21 states in the United States today as I'm speaking. So we're the worst flooding in West Georgia's history right now, today as I'm speaking. So I'm just letting you know that if you're planning your future, don't plan it at the sea level, because there's almost an absolute certainty that within the next 5 years, there's going to be massive flooding with storm surges, hurricanes in those areas. And all of those buildings, every single building from Key West to the end of Florida, they're all going to be history because they're all built on sand, not stone. And therefore, the concrete pilings that are supporting that, in time as the water comes in at night, it pulls the sand underneath, it shifts the weight-bearing load, and that's going to cause structural fractures in the buildings, making them uninhabitable. And there's not enough money in the world to fix all those buildings. You're simply going to have to move. And I'm not telling people to run out tomorrow and, you know, throw their hands in the air and run in circles. I'm simply saying that there are places you shouldn't live, that you should, in a timely and non-rush manner, you should be looking at where you ideally should live for quality of life, employment, sustainability, and then make your effort to get to that place. That's reasonable. It's not panicky. But if this happens in the way it does, and I'm almost certain will happen, we're going to have at least 50 million Americans adversely affected in the next couple of years. I'm Gary Nall. We're now, I'm being told that our guest is on the line. So let's go to speak with my guest, who's standing by. He is Bruce Fine. He is one of the country's leading constitutional and international attorneys, active in civil liberty law, now a principal in government affairs with the Litchfield Group in Washington. Earlier, he was an associate deputy attorney general and general counsel to the Federal Communications Commission and under President Reagan. He also served on Ron Paul's chief legal counsel. And during the course of his career, he has been highly critical of all succeeding presidents, having advocated impeachments of President Clinton, Bush, and Cheney, as well as Barack Obama, for the invasion of Libya and the failure to prosecute Bush officials for their justification of torture and surveillance of the public. He is now the legal attorney for Lonnie Snowden, the father of Edward Snowden, isolated at the Moscow airport to assure Snowden's constitutional rights and safety in the event he turns himself in and returns to the U.S. He's written several books, his latest being American Empire Before the Fall, which condemns the nation's aggressive foreign policy in the quest of world domination. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Yesterday, the Bradley Manning case came to a conclusion, at least one part of it, and he was found guilty in a military court on 19 counts, 6 for espionage, but not for aiding enemies of the state, with incarceration of up to 136 years. And now there's growing concern that Edward Snowden would likely face a similar fate, even with federal assurances from Attorney General Eric Holder, if Edward returns to the U.S., he wouldn't be tortured or killed. Now, in the midst of this, the full scope of the government spending hundreds of billions of dollars and speeding ahead to turn the country into an intelligence and military police state, mass surveillance and data collection of all citizens is in full public view. A recent poll from Pew Research has now shown that the majority of Americans believe that the National Security Agency has overreached its authority, and 70% believe that the NSA is collecting intelligence on citizens for reason other than the so-called war on terror. And the national public atmosphere today seems to clearly indicate that there is very little trust and respect for any word issued out of the White House and Congress. So what I'd like to do is have you address some of these issues. And first, do you believe that we are emerging into a police state, or do you believe that we are and have been in a police state?
We certainly have the legal architecture of a police state, because the claimed authority of the executive branch to spy on Americans without any suspicion of individualized wrongdoing is limitless. And the only reason why we aren't quite as bad as some of the historical police states we associate with the Third Reich or Communist China is because the executive branch has indulged us a little bit of privacy, but there's nothing in the law that the executive branch claims to change when the president asks for national security reasons that prevent us from being characterized as a police state. And just to give one example, one that actually has not been mentioned, it's sort of been submerged in the issue of the limitless dragnet surveillance of Americans under the Patriot Act. Remember, the President of the United States still claims that he has authority in secret to place anybody on an assassination list and to vaporize or extinguish anybody with a predator drone, based upon his conclusion alone that you may be an imminent danger of perpetrating a terrorist act. There's no review by any court, by any legislative body. He holds the power of life and death, according to his legal authority over every living being on the planet. Now, it's hard to even describe any more tyrannical power that could be placed on one individual. And that's just emblematic, I think, of how far our legal architecture has crumbled from the time of the Founding Fathers, when we were revolting against the king because he didn't provide us with jury trials instead of trials for admiralty courts. You know, now we don't even do trials at all. But certainly, I think the legal architecture is in place for a police state now, and it takes little bits more, perhaps another incident similar to a 9/11 or even a threatened 9/11, and then I think all the actual political constraints will fall, and we will be indistinguishable from, say, the state of Stasi in East Germany during the Cold War.
I appreciate that oversight. You're familiar with the Princeton political scientist Sheldon Wolin, right?
Yes.
He called our current state inverted totalitarianism, where citizens' participation in what they believe is a democracy with elections has simply become a ritual with little meaning and significance. And the Obama administration and Bush before him and Clinton before him does whatever it wishes, regardless of the public support behind the policies. They have their agenda. And time and again, when I look at their agenda, I have to ask a basic question. If you're having a war on terror, why is it that we, the American public, are now suspect if we protest anything? Why do you need our phone records, all of our electronic information? Why do you need to infiltrate any peaceful gathering of individuals who, like Occupy or any other group or a group of environmentalists? Why are we now suspect because we're exercising a constitutional right of our First Amendment? And why is it that you feel you have the right as a government and your agencies to classify over 90 million documents last year as secret, with almost 5 million people having a secret clearance, when many of those people, over 90% of the agencies or individuals who have secret clearances to collect and gather and share information on a person's private life, their medical background, their anything and everything about them that the government can collect, those are for-profit corporations. They have nothing to do with the government. They're in this private, and yet these people have that.
No, everything that you've said is certainly accurate, and it is true that the government is in the business of frightening people into thinking they need to surrender their civil liberties and freedoms in order to avoid dead bodies on the sidewalk. And it's relatively easy to frighten people when you claim all this harrowing information is secret and can't be disclosed because the enemy would engage in tactics of evasion. And if you don't have honesty in the government, you get people frightened and not being skeptical of these claims. And what should we think when we have a director of national intelligence who, when asked by a senator, Ron Wyden, are you collecting data on millions of Americans? And he says, no, And it's a flat-out lie, and he's not rebuked, he's not relieved of office. He probably couldn't even get a security clearance if he was a junior officer trying to be recruited by the CIA because of his past practices of deception. And yet he now is the director of national intelligence, and we're supposed to take his word, oh, no, they wouldn't look at the contents of all the information that they've gathered. They'd only get a court warrant before that would happen. And the whole idea of a self-governing people and transparency is that when it comes to matters of power, we bind our rulers down by the Constitution, not by goodwill or pledges that they'll be honest. And the other thing that's relevant, I think, with regard to these National Security Agency programs is they're so-called self-audited. You don't have outside parties coming in to determine what is the nature of their compliance with these court orders or the statutes. And it's like asking someone to grade his own exam and he keeps getting A pluses. That's not how you do oversight. You need to have outside people come in and examine what's going on. And that's the way in which you check abuses. But the ultimate larger issue that you've raised is the nature of our country itself. And instead of the presumption being freedom and liberty and the burden on the government to demonstrate why they have to encroach upon that freedom, the right to be left alone, we've inverted that fundamental philosophical principle. And the idea is, hey, the government can do whatever it wants to spy and surveil you, and if you protest, what do you have to hide? The opposite of what a free society should be founded upon. And that is, in some sense, the most fundamental pathology of the country today. Instead of standing up and saying, I don't need to give a reason why I want to be left alone, that's inherent in being a human being. You, the government, have to give a reason why you should disturb my privacy. But that's not the questions that are asked today. I was at a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on these programs this morning, and it was really stunning to see how errant the members were on all sides of the aisle as to the philosophy of the Constitution itself and the default position of liberty, not government and truth.
I appreciate those very important insights you just shared with us. Thank you. Just one more question for you. There is a much larger issue, I believe, that the Manning and Snowden cases present, and is important because we're not realizing that the major media have not addressed it. When we look at the National Security Agency system, it's largely being operated through private corporations, all with political contacts. Booz Allen, that Snowden worked for, Henry Wallace, in a New York Times piece in 1944, warned of the possibility of fascism taking over the U.S., and among many of the indicators he identified as the modern age of technology to facilitate totalitarian efforts and the industries creating these technologies, as we are witnessing with high-tech surveillance technologies, can be used to subjugate people rather than liberate them into a more democratic process. And Wallace also warned of industry leaders, although at the time he didn't include the banking industry, that what he said, quote, willing to jeopardize the structure of American liberty to gain temporary advantage. And he warned of the, quote, deliberate perversion of truth and fact through the big media to create a disunity that would enable government to impugn democracy. And the thoughtful person can witness these many other warnings of Henry Wallace unfolding before us now. So my question is quite simple. That with the National Security Agency machinery to essentially categorize every American citizen as either a proponent, meaning a patriot, but only defined by whichever administration is in office, or an enemy of the government in power, have we not at least entered the beginning of a totalitarian state today?
Certainly we have, and I say it goes back to this principle that our legal architecture recognizes limitless government power. You just wave a national security banner and you can do anything you want. including virtually suspending the Constitution, suspending habeas corpus, suspending laws against torture, suspending laws against homicide, suspending due process. And that is, we're already in that realm. It's not like we have to wait. And it's only political checks that prevent the country from turning into a actual tyranny instead of a de jure tyranny, which is what we have at present. And this is Henry Wallace was really just foreshadowing what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, and now it's the military-industrial counterterrorism complex, but it's all the same thing. And now we've got a situation where we've sort of subcontracted out our policy in these counterterrorism areas to companies whose motive is to make money and not to help the American people. And again, that's an earmark of a country that's lost its soul, so to speak, and that's what we have to recover if we are ever going to resist the self-ruination that all empires tumble in.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate your efforts in to trying to understand why a chief executive of the United States should be held accountable and should not allow those that preceded them to walk away as Obama let Bush and Cheney walk away from what many of us consider crimes against humanity. And it may be another 10 or 20 years before we are at a place politically where we have the courage to look at the deeds of these individuals and then go back and hold them accountable, much like Chile did with Pinochet.
Yes, it's only going to happen if the American people cease being complacent and stand up. That's the history of civilization, the history of civic courage, in some cases requiring civil disobedience. If you are a people of sheep, you will get a government of wolves, and that has been true from time immemorial and faith. But we control our destiny. History is biography, and every listener should recognize, however small they think they are, their voice counts. Ultimately, we will direct the destiny of the nation for good or for ill, and we cannot escape our moral accountability. We can't just blame it on leaders or elected officials or whatever. It's us. We have the sovereignty. We have an obligation to discharge.
Thank you very much, Bruce Fine. You're one of the country's leading constitutional and international attorneys. You're very active in civil liberties law. And you also were an associate deputy attorney general and general counsel to the Federal Trade Commission under President Reagan, and you also served as Ron Paul's chief legal counsel. You've done a lot to make us aware of how far we've strayed from true constitutional principles. I thank you, and I know the audience is interested in what you had to say.
Thank
All the best
you.
To you.
All right.
I'm Gary Nall. Now let's shift over to examining our environmental segment. It's rare to get someone on. I apologize for the poor quality. He was having to speak on an emergency line because he wasn't at a regular desk. Hopefully you were able to hear him. Peak oil has generated headlines in recent years, but the real threat to our future, I believe, is peak water. There are substitutes for oil. There's no substitute for water. We can produce food without oil. We cannot produce food without water. We drink on average about 4 quarts, that's about 4.5 liters of water per day, in one form or another. But the food we eat each day requires 2,000 quarts of water to produce, or 500 times as much as we consume. Getting enough water to drink is relatively easy, but finding enough to produce the ever-growing quantity of grain the world consumes is another matter. Grain consumed directly supplies nearly half of our calories. That consumed indirectly as meat, milk, and eggs supplies a large part of the remainder, and today roughly 40% of the world's grain harvest comes from irrigated land. It thus comes as no surprise that irrigation expansion has played a central role in tripling the world grain harvest over the last 6 decades. And during the last half of the 20th century, the world's irrigated area expanded from 93 million hectares, that's about 232 million acres, to over 700 million acres today. This tripling of the world irrigation within 50 years was historically unique. But since then, the growth in irrigation has come to a near standstill, expanding only 9% in the last 10 years. Farmers get their irrigation water either from rivers or from underground aquifers. And historically, beginning with the Sumerians 6,000 years ago, irrigation water came from building dams across rivers and creating reservoirs that then enable them to divert the water onto the land through a network of gravity-fed canals. And this method of irrigation prevailed until the mid-20th century. But with few remaining sites for building dams, the prospects of expanding surface irrigation faded. Farmers then turned to drilling wells to tap underground water resources. In doing so, they learned that there are two types of aquifers, those that are replenished through rainfall, which are in the majority, and those that consist of water laid down eons, millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of years ago, and these do not recharge. When they're out forever. The latter, known as fossil aquifers, include two strategically important ones, the deep aquifer under the North China Plain and the Ulagalla aquifer under the U.S. Western Great Plains. In looking at water and our future, we face many questions and few answers. Could the world be facing peak water, or has it already passed? Tapping underground water resources, which got seriously underway in the mid-20th century, helped expand world food production. But as the demand for grain continued climbing, the amount of water pumped continued to grow. Eventually, the extraction of water began to exceed the recharge rate of aquifers from precipitation, and water tables began to fall. In effect, overpumping creates a water-based food bubble, one that will burst when the aquifer is depleted and the rate of pumping is necessarily reduced to the rate of recharge from rain. Today, some 18 countries containing half the world's population are overpumping their aquifers. Among the big three grain producers, China, India, and the United States, and several other populations, including Iran, Pakistan, and Mexico, they're all overpumping. And during the last two decades, several of these countries have overpumped to the point that their aquifers are being depleted and their wells are going dry. They have passed not only peak water, but also peak grain production. Their aquifers are being depleted, their wells are going dry, and their grain harvests are shrinking. Among the countries whose water has peaked and began to decline are Saudi Arabia, Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. In these countries, peak grain has followed peak water. Nowhere are falling water tables and shrinkages of irrigated agriculture more dramatic than in Saudi Arabia, a country as water poor as it is oil rich. After the Arab oil export embargo of 1975, the Saudis realized they were vulnerable to a counter-embargo on grain. To become self-sufficient in wheat, they began to develop heavily subsidized irrigated agriculture based largely on pumping water from fossil aquifers. After being self-sufficient in wheat for 20 years, the Saudis announced in 2008 that with their aquifers largely depleted, they would reduce wheat planting by 1/8 each year till 2 years from now, when their production would simply end. And by then, Saudi projects, it will be importing about 15 million tons of wheat, rice, corn, and barley to feed its 30 million people. It is the first country to publicly project how aquifer depletion will shrink its grain harvest. Syria, a country of 22 million people riddled by civil war, is also overpumping its underground water. Its grain production peaked in 2002. And during the decade since then, it's dropped by 30%. It, too, is becoming heavily dependent upon imported grain. And grain production in neighboring Iraq peaked in 2004. And by 2012, it had dropped 33%, forcing the government to turn to the world market to feed its people. In addition to aquifer depletion, both Syria and Iraq are also suffering to a lesser degree from reduced flow in the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, as upstream Turkey claims more water for its own use. In Yemen, a nation of 23 million people that shares a long border with Saudi Arabia, the water table is falling at roughly 4 feet a year as water use outstrips aquifer recharge. With one of the world's fastest growing populations, with water tables falling everywhere, Yemen is fast becoming a hydrological basket case. Grain production has fallen by over half in the last 35 years. And by next year, irrigated fields will be a rarity, and the country will be importing virtually all of its grain. Living on borrowed water and borrowed time, Yemen could disintegrate into an area of tribes fighting over water. Thus, in the Arab Middle East, the world is seeing the collusion between population growth and water supply at a regional level. For the first time in history, grain production is dropping in a geographic region where, with nothing in sight to arrest the decline. And because the failure of governments in the region to mesh population and water policies, each day now brings 10,000 more people to feed and less irrigated water with which to feed them. Other countries with much larger populations, such as Iran, Pakistan, and Mexico, are also near their peak water. In Iran, a country of 81 million people, grain production dropped 10% in just the last 5 years as irrigation wells started to go dry. One quarter of its current grain harvest is based on overpumping. And with populations growing by over a million per year, it faces a day of reckoning. Pakistan, with a population of 177 million that is growing by 4 million people a year, is also mining its underground water. Most of its irrigation water comes from the Indus River system, but in the Pakistan part of the fertile Punjab plain, the drop in water tables appears to be similar to the well-known fall that is occurring in India. And when you look at the twin city of Islamabad and others show a drop in water that is substantial. In a World Bank study, water experts said, quote, Pakistan is already one of the most water-stressed countries in the world. In Mexico, home to a population of 109 million that is projected to reach 129 million in the near future, the demand for water is outstripping supply. Mexico City's water problems are well known. Rural areas are also suffering. And then you have the big three, China, yes, in the United States and India, we're all running out of water, and our populations are increasing. And yet we do not have any national policy, international policy, to deal with all this. Just look at one state, just Colorado. In the western states, hardly a day goes by without the announcement of a new sale. Half or more of all sales are by individual farmers or their irrigation districts to cities, municipalities. Why? Because the only way they can get income is to sell underground water. But when you sell the underground water, what's needed when the water goes dry? And that's happening. Cities in Colorado are amongst the fastest growing populations in the United States, yet they're running out of water. In the Arkansas River Basin, which occupies the southeastern quarter of the state, Colorado Springs and Aurora, a subdivision, have been already bought water rights to one-third of the basin's farmland. And Colorado is not alone in losing irrigation water. Farmers in India are already losing their irrigation water to cities. And so cities are running out of water. States are running out of water. Countries like China, with four-fifths of its grain harvest coming from irrigated land, relies heavily on irrigation, but it's largely river water. And it's very polluted, which means that the ground that polluted water goes on is polluted. That means the food it is grown is polluted. Of the big three countries, the most vulnerable to overpumping is India. Three-fifths of its grain harvest comes from irrigated land, and it's running out of that water. And yet, nothing is being done. I only bring this to you as an example of how we have major crisis occurring and not a word about it anywhere, as if it doesn't matter. It does, just like the environment, just like the rising seas, just like the worsening of our climate. What happens when we are in denial for so long of a problem that the problem overtakes us? I'm Gary Nall. Thank you very much for listening. Now we'll go over and say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. You know, interestingly, I've been getting emails from your audience with regard to the 2010 Gulf oil spill. And it's been in the news that, not in major media, but in some of the less familiar media, Halliburton's pleading guilty to destroying Gulf oil spill evidence. They agreed to plead guilty to destroying evidence related to the spill. And basically, they're connected to this. And what they're doing is they're pleading guilty to a misdemeanor charge that's part of the bigger issue with BP and Transocean. And according to the government, Halliburton recommended to BP that the Macondo well contained 21 centralizers, metal collars that can improve cementing, but BP chose to use six. So Halliburton is pretty much pulling back and saying, hey, you know, we told them what to do, and yet they destroyed evidence for this whole investigation. And, of course, everybody wants to get your thoughts on this.
I don't look at this as significant in and of itself, because every day major multinational corporations simply engage in deceitful or immoral or illegal activities. If you or I did what Halliburton did, we would be brought up on charges of obstruction of justice, and that's a federal crime. More important is that Halliburton will continue to receive favored status in Congress, and their members, lobbyists, and former government employees who work for Halliburton will continue to have free access to the White House and virtually all of Washington. They'll continue to make tens of billions of dollars a year for supplying food and water and other sources, purification systems, for our engagements in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places. So on the one hand, we will not allow someone who has a history of repeat crimes against humanity to be accepted by the public. And yet here, corporate America are nothing but repeat criminals. And that shows us a lot about the government accepting the word of repeat criminal organizations, but not allowing progressive-minded individuals or progressive companies to have an opportunity to serve the public. They are just dismissed out of hand. That is the metastasis of corruption of this system. Thank you, Luann. Let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today I'm taking a look at this cyber surveillance program through my own unique, dare I say the word, prism.
Okay. We look forward to it. Utrice Lead right now. Please stay with us.